You sit on the throne absolutely with a laptop. What's wrong with you, you horrific pikey? I tell you what.
I earn a significant portion of my daily income sitting on that throne. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I want to thank everyone for tuning in to what is possibly the most important episode of Bad Voltage ever conceived by man. This is the 10th episode, which means, if you're following along at home, that this is the episode at which Bad Voltage becomes a real podcast. Because if you don't make it to 10 episodes, you're not real. Think about that. Think of how many podcasts make it through 9 shows and then just go nowhere. Disappear into the neither. That's not us.
Does that mean that we have, there's no likelihood of us ever pod fading right now?
Ever. We are right now like a giant block of podcasting granite. We are in the mountain. We are the Mount Rushmore of podcasts right now with the four of our faces looking friggin' fantastic. This is Bad Voltage, episode 10. My name is Brian Lunduke.
And I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Jonah Bacon.
I'm Stuart Langridge.
I would like to point out that all of us have last names except Jeremy. Hey, Jeremy, what's going on the show today?
Well, what we're going to talk about is what our favorite tech conferences are, and a disturbing and very disconcerting segue in that, what kind of underwear Jono prefers.
We're also going to be doing an interview with Miguel de Caza, the founder of GNOME and Zimian and Xamarin, and we're going to be asking him why some people think he's a bit of a traitor.
I've got a new computer and I'm in theory going to review it and in practice start an argument about why laptops are rubbish.
Probably. And we're going to have a segment all about whistleblowing because this is a podcast run by nerds and that's something that you do.
And of course, we had the Bad Voltage selfie contest recently. We had some great selfies sent in. We're going to be announcing the winner and the runner-ups.
And at the end, we saved the best for last. We're going to be talking about general, random, community-ish stuff. Hey, Jeremy, what's that mean?
And now, Bad Voltage. So, I know all of us on this panel have attended a fair amount of tech conferences, so the question that I have for you guys is, what do you think your favorite conference is, and why? So, why don't we start with you, Brian?
With me? Oh,
yeah,
Lord.
Oh, yeah.
All right, I got two answers. One is the current conference I like the most. I like the community-run stuff. I like kind of like the small to mid-sized conferences because they're the most chill. So, I kind of like things like Linux Fest Northwest and things like that. That's currently one of my favorites. In the days of yore, in the old tech days, my favorite, and you guys have to cut me some slack on this one, was Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference pre like 2002, 2003. Those things were epic. Apple, this was before they moved it to San Francisco and got mega douchey. They had the greatest spreads. There was donuts piled to the sky. They literally
the greatest spreads.
It was awesome, man.
Really?
It was fantastic.
The antics at the early 2000 conferences in general.
Yeah, right. That's exactly it. Back in 2000 and like the late 90s, there was something about the developer conferences, especially the ones that were hosted by companies. They were always trying to one-up each other and trying to be the coolest dev conference, and Apple's were the most crazy. They had a table, a long table, a conference table filled with candy. Not a little candy. We're talking like 3 feet high of assorted king-size candy bars. I mean, thousands and thousands of candy bars. It was the stupidest thing. So by the end of the conference, every developer was sick and hungover from sugar crashing, and other things. But it was an amazing conference for that reason alone. And they're stupid now. The WWDCs aren't even worth going to. At least they haven't been for hundreds of years
stupid.
Now.
So they're stupid because the spread isn't as good as it used to be. Is that right? This is not a child's picnic.
Your definition for other reasons, but the spread was great.
Yeah. Your definition of a good conference appears to be, I can get free food.
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit.
This furthers the theory that we've had for a while that you might actually be homeless, Brian.
It's entirely possible.
It's fine. All right. I mean, you can go to some other conference like Scale and just eat out of the bins. No one minds.
Wait. The bins? Wait, what did they? Are you going to conferences where they just have food bins? Like, what are the bins? I don't even understand this bin thing.
I don't know.
He meant trash. Language thing.
I did. Yeah. I did mean the trash.
It's a British word.
We are divided
word.
By a
getting back
knowledge.
On track there.
All right. What about you, John? What's your favorite con?
For me, I kind of break it into two areas. I think there's the kind of community organized ones, and then there's the big kind of more. I guess you could say more professional ones, but the community ones are very professional as well. By far my favorite in the US, well, in the world, is Scale, in the Southern California Linux Expo. That's actually where I met Jeremy about 10 years ago. And just every year, it's just consistently brilliant. We know the organizers, and they're really good people. It started out of like a lug years ago. And when I first went, and when Jeremy first went, it was probably about 500 or 600 people, I think. And now it's like 2,500 people, and it's big and professional, but it still maintained that community spirit that's always made Scale very special. And it's brilliant. And what's cool about it these days is on the Friday before Scale kicks off, they have almost a mini FOSDEM where they have like lots of individual tracks. So we had NabooCon there and some other bits and pieces. So It's just really cool.
That's awesome.
Other than that, on the more professional, bigger thing, for me, it's OSCON. You know, a lot of people give OSCON a lot of grief because they think it's all, you know, a bit sellouty. But I still think it's a lot of fun, and it's, you know, it's weird because I never go to conference sessions. I never go and watch talks. I'm always there to chat to people outside of the conference track. And I still find it really useful to go to OSCON and have a good set of meetings and whatever else.
So. But if you don't go to the talks, then you're missing out on finding out how to leverage open source synergies in a vertical market, which is what OSCON is entirely about, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, but as Mark Shuttleworth's lapdog, I'm already doing that.
So. You know, it's kind of interesting. We had a quick chat about this before we started recording, and my answer was identical to Jono's. And I think for pretty much the same reasons. And for OSCON specifically, I think it's the hallway track is what makes OSCON. You know, going to the tracks itself, some of them are actually very good, but some of them are a little, especially for the last few years, a little synergistic, if you will. But the hallway track at OSCON is kind of difficult to beat, I think. And I think to Scale's credit, when you go to the other local conferences like Linux West, Northwest, or OLF, or any of those, they all kind of aspire to be Scale. If you talk to the you know, the organizers or the people there, and I think that's a testament to really the trend that Scale helped start. Is those little, you know, smaller local
totally
conferences
right.
are just amazing.
You're totally right. Like Linux Fest Northwest, Ohio Linux Fest, and they're all getting huge now. Linux Fest Northwest last year is just shy of 2,000 attendees. And so even these small ones that have kind of seen as nipping at the heels of Scale are now Scale in size, which means we've got multiple fests all across the nation that are like that, that are community driven, which I think is just rad.
Which I think it's absolutely awesome. Yep. So, what about you? What do you think?
They have, in fact, scaled. I'm a bit different to you guys, I think. I don't like big conferences.
No surprise there.
Well, you know.
GingerCon.
That'd be brilliant. Someone organises that, I'll go. I don't like big conferences much. I mean, I've never been to Scale. I'd like to go, but I've never been. But I've been to OSCON. I've been to South by Southwest and things like that. And really big conferences, I don't like them so much, whether they're community-run or corporate-run. There's just too much stuff. You spend the whole time seeing people who you haven't seen for ages for 15 minutes, and then that's the end of it. I prefer something a bit smaller. So the one I'd pick here in the UK is Full Frontal, which is a web conference. It's run down in Brighton, and it's only for a couple of hundred people. One of the things that has happened quite a lot in the UK web scene over the last few years is a lot of little conferences sprung up, 80 or 100, 150 people. Now, I think some of that is because we just have fewer people than you do in America, right? I mean, it's actually quite difficult to put together a conference with 3,000 people because that's like half of everyone who lives here. But
you are England is a pinhead on the expanse of the planet, to be fair.
Yeah.
However, it's where all the angels dance, unlike America. But I like small conferences. So little things like that. I prefer them to be community run, much the same as you do. So done by people who would otherwise be attending the conference rather than being run by some company just purely in order to make money. We organised Lug Radio Live and it was that same kind of feel, you know. You don't get the impression that anyone is running the rest of their business for the year on the profits they made from the conference. Tickets are 50 quid or 5 quid rather than 2,000.
Right. You know, yeah, you make a pretty good point.
Speakers
there.
Are paid an honorarium. You know, now, that's the sort of thing I like. So I'd name Full Frontal from here.
When you go to the big conferences, do you guys feel like a lot of times when you go to the big conferences, you go to the OzCons and whatnot, it kind of breaks off into a bunch of little mini conferences. Like you end up grabbing hold of your people, you grab hold of the people who are excited to see you and you're excited to see them, and you kind of create your own mini con in a way.
That is precisely what happens.
Yeah, it's awesome.
In fact, I hang out with Jeremy at every single one of these conferences.
It's supposed to be, you know, a networking event or whatever, but you end up networking with just the people you'd go to the pub with anyway.
Yeah, well,
you know, it's actually great.
Yeah, but to be fair, we've met a lot of those people at one conference or another.
Exactly.
So.
There's some people I only see at specific conferences every year, and that's kind of exciting.
I agree.
I think a lot of it as well is that, like, I mean, speaking personally, like, when I'm at these conferences, I'm usually in meetings most of the day. And then in the evening, you kind of want to kick back and hang out with your friends to a degree. And, it's not like you say you don't want to hang out with other people, but you tend to hang out with people who you get on with in a social capacity as well. And then often there's other people around as well. I have a final question as we bring this to a close. if each of you had to name a conference that is no longer happening these days, that you'd love to bring back, or alternatively, if you can't think of one of those, a conference you'd love to go to that you've never been to before, what would it be?
Live Voltage.
Let's start with you, Ack. Live Voltage is definitely the one.
A good Live Voltage con would be nice.
No, we're not doing a Bad Voltage conference. Get stuffed.
Yes, we are at some point.
And I'm not picking Lug Radio Live either, because I'd have to organize.
I've actually never been to South by Southwest, and that's one that I would like to go to. One day.
I would actually like to go to South by Southwest as well.
It's alarmingly super douchey. It's like a douche black hole. You go there. you know how people talk about the Bay Area and the Valley as a whole being full of ponces in scarves who care about nothing but how they're going to, you know, IPO for 200 million. South by Southwest is that, but concentrated down into brandy rather than the wine that is the Bay Area. Austin's really nice, though.
It can't be worse than Burning Man, though, surely. I mean, Burning Man seems to be like the cathedral in which the douches of the world unite and worship each other.
But the point is that Burning Man is only there just to hang out, be a penis for a week. That's it. That's all it's for, right? South by, everyone's also handing out business cards the whole time. So it's not just smoking dope on the player, right?
Yeah.
So what's the one you want to bring back, Jono?
I have to say, it would be fun to do I share Axe's concerns about this, but Lug Radio Live I thought was awesome. And I mean, obviously we were involved in the organization of it, but it was a really unique event, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, if Bad Voltage continues to grow, we've seen a ton of growth of Bad Voltage and like people are getting into it. It would be fun to do something similar, because I think there is a niche out there for a conference that is not just community driven, but really fun and focuses on fun a lot. And, you know, I think that Live Voltage could be a replacement for Lug Radio Live, but only if there's enough momentum. But yeah,
it cost an awful lot to fly you three to Wolverhampton as well.
Yeah, that's not happening.
No.
So actually, I know we're running pretty close on time here, but I'm going to end this segment with a story that I think is kind of succinctly says why smaller open source conferences are kind of cool in a way that I don't know a lot of other conferences are. And it was one of the first MySQL user conferences around 2004, I want to say, whatever the first one that was in Santa Clara. And so this is obviously before Oracle, before Sun. It was just MySQL AB. And I was talking to one of the engineers for MySQL, I think his name was Sergey, after his talk, and it was about an issue we were having with full text in MySQL, which is what at the time we used for search at LQ. We've since moved to Sphinx. And Monty, the founder of MySQL, jumped out of his chair. He was in the first row, had about a 10-minute conversation with me, sat down, checked something into BitKeeper, and gave me a test build to see if it fixed my issue. So you're talking about the founder of the company stopped what he was doing at his conference to check in a custom build, and it actually did fix our problem. So I think that's what's cool about those smaller open source conferences.
Nice. I suspect that does not happen at WWDC.
Dear Lord,
I have an example that is the opposite of that, which also affects small conferences. So while we were at Scale this last weekend, I was having a private conversation with Gareth, who's one of the organizers of Scale, and a couple of other people. And I was telling them a story about when I was in Sydney, I bought this comedy chicken thong. Now, I appreciate that this, you know, doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense, but I thought it would be hilarious.
It already makes total sense. Chicken thong.
And what's great about this is it's a yellow thong. You know, you kind of put the chicken, if you will, into the body of it. There's little googly eyes on the side. And the best thing about it is these legs hang down, right? It looks ridiculous. So from mentioning this conversation briefly with Gareth, it then appeared in a quiz at Scale. So now everybody at Scale knows about this chicken thong. And that's one of the other things that I like about, on one hand, that's not good because everybody thinks I wear a chicken thong. But on the other hand, it's that kind of personal feel that I think makes a lot of these small conferences really important and really fun. Like, people are not there and not taking themselves too seriously. It's always a good time.
Yep.
Months ago, my laptop, which is a Lenovo Ultrabook running Ubuntu, decided to corrupt its disk when resuming from suspend. Now, admittedly, I'd suspended it and then I let it run out of battery, and I'd understand if it lost my session, but no, it wouldn't boot at all. A few panicked hours later, and with quite a bit of help from Hashubuntu UK on IRC, I got it back and I hadn't lost anything. However, tragically, this now meant my formerly innocent SSD had learned about the existence of disk errors. If you've worked in an office, you'll know you mustn't use whiteboard cleaner, because once you've taught a whiteboard that special cleaning fluid exists, it sulks and it refuses to be cleaned without it forever and ever more. Well, disks are just the same. Once they've learned that they're allowed to error and you'll just fix it, they feel able, actually they feel obliged, to throw more errors, just to see how much you'll put up with. So I started shopping around for a new laptop. Over Christmas, my mum, who is lovely, but is about as good with technology as I am with blindfold rock climbing, she said, "Why are you buying a laptop? Why not buy a desktop computer?" This is a better question than you might initially think. What benefit is there to a laptop? Well, there are, I think, two things. The first is it's got a zillion peripherals built in. Speakers, mouse, webcam, keyboard, it's all part of the one package. And the second, you can use it without it being plugged in. Other than that, every single thing about a desktop computer is better. It's more upgradable, it's cheaper, it's prettier. If you try and buy prettier, this rather than a ghastly beige case from the 80s. It's got more USB ports. You can make one which works how you want it to, rather than how your laptop manufacturer wants it to. I want loads of RAM and a gorgeous case, and I couldn't give a damn about graphics, as long as it can drive my 27-inch monitor. So that's what I built. There are quite a lot of custom PC builders. There's no way on God's green earth that I'm going to buy a bunch of components and fit them together myself. For a start, I don't give a crap about which type of RAM fits in which motherboard. I want someone else to decide that for me. I don't want to have to touch a radiator, wear anti-static strips, lose all those tiny screws every 9 seconds. So I shopped around a bit, ended up with PC Specialist, who are a custom PC builder here in the UK. I got an Inwin 904 case, which is stone cold gorgeous. Tempered glass, it's brushed steel, it's a bloody work of art is what it is. And all the RAM I can stuff in my pockets, decent Logitech speakers and webcam and wireless mouse and keyboard, an Asus 27-inch monitor, HDMI, just everything I wanted, pretty well priced, and I can stick with it almost forever. If you remember Trigger's broom in Only Fools and Horses, it had 16 new heads and 14 new handles. This machine can be poked, you can have bits swapped out, it can keep on trucking long after any 5 laptops have been consigned to the laptop graveyard in your basement, or worse still, the slow death of being given to your parents. So well done, PC specialist. But it leads me to wonder, why do we buy laptops at all?
So this is a little different, right? We're not really talking so much of a review of a specific thing. We're really talking about a review of this PC that you put together.
Exactly.
The transition that you've gone through from laptop to PC, right?
Yeah, I could quite happily tell you what's in this machine, but you really don't want me just reading out motherboard model numbers and, oh, I've got this particular type of RAM like anyone gives a crap, right?
Now, before we go on, I think you should probably explain to our American listeners what triggers Broom is in Horse and Horses, because a lot of people are not going to get that.
Yes, I was going to say, I had a Wikipedia, and you didn't even get the number of handles right.
I was doing it from memory. Amateur. Right? There's a show called Only Fools and Horses, comedy show in England, and there was a guy in it called Trigger who was very, very, very stupid. And he won an award from the council for having saved the money because over 20 years as a road sweeper, he'd only ever used one broom. And that had saved him a bunch of money. You guys call it a broom, right? It's not a brush or something. The thing you...
Because brooms are outrageously expensive?
It's a freedom brush.
This was the point. He'd mentioned to the council he'd had kept the same broom for 20 years and they gave him an award. And then he revealed that over that 20 years, the broom had had 17 new heads and 13 new handles or whatever the numbers are. I didn't look it up on Wikipedia. But that was the point.
Right.
I concede that I forgot the analogy probably holds a bit less water outside these shores.
Yeah.
I think the thing I found odd was your what benefit is there to a laptop? And so having discussed conferences in another segment in this episode, the benefit of a laptop is that I'm not going to strap a desktop to my back and go on a plane and carry that thing around Scale or OSCON with me.
Yeah.
Which is that exactly why I said you can use it without it being plugged in, which is great. If you travel a lot, fine. You need a laptop, yes. And there's no way I could have considered sticking with a desktop until the last year or so because I was at conferences the whole time and everything. But in practice, certainly over the previous year when I was going to conferences, I wasn't taking the laptop I used every day. And I know quite a lot of people now have two laptops, the one which sits on their desk and does all their work, and then they take a MacBook Air or they take a tablet or something like that to conferences. Right.
Well, if you take a tablet, don't bring a keyboard because we know you hate convergence.
If you're going to have some kind of portable device, whether it's a tablet or it's a MacBook Air or some kind of Ultrabook or whatever, and then have another thing at home, have a desktop machine, for God's sake. They're better. There's no point in buying a laptop where the stuff wears out quicker and it all costs more money and it's less replaceable. If all you can do is leave it on your desk anyway.
Well, for a lot of people, their attitude towards a laptop and a desktop is the same because most people don't know how to put together a desktop computer or how to upgrade stuff in a desktop computer. It still is just this mystery box. It might be a mystery box that sits under your desk with a big screen attached to it, but they don't understand how to change RAM and how to change stuff. I agree that for nerds, it's quite easy.
You can open up, poor Jono.
It's like Lego, basically, right? You can open it up and you can put different bricks in there. But for you, Ak, it probably makes perfect sense. But for a lot of regular consumers, it's not necessarily any different, you know?
I think it's interesting that the world has shifted to the point where if you're going looking for a computer, now what everyone does is look for laptops. And if you're a manufacturer, this must be absolutely brilliant for you because your margins are higher on a laptop. People replace them more often. The parts cost more, right? And it feels like there's this slight scam being put over on us by the PC people of the world to convince us all to move to laptops which aren't as good because they make more money.
All right, yeah. All right. Here's the thing, though. Recliners, bed, toilet. There you go. That's why you need to have laptops. If you don't have laptops, I mean, you're not gonna grab your big beige tower and shove it on your lap while you're dropping a number two. The redheaded stepchildren get dropped off at the pool, but you got to have something to do while you're sitting there. Sometimes your tablet does it. Sometimes your cell phone does it. Sometimes you need a bit more power.
You absolutely do not. You sit on the phone absolutely with a laptop. Need it. What's wrong with you, you horrific pikey?
I tell you what. I earn a significant portion of my daily income sitting on that throne or sitting in a recliner or heading out back and sitting on a chair in the sunshine, heading to the park, sitting right there. It's just so nice to be able to be wherever the heck I want to be.
Yeah, unless you're agoraphobic, having a laptop really is a necessity, I think. If you're in this industry, especially.
I will bear in mind, Brian, next time I'm reading something that you've written for one of the many publications you write for, that what you were doing was putting out shit.
At least a 30% chance I was multitasking.
You might want to check your colon out because
there's a disconcerting amount of feces discussed in this show, I will say.
but to go back to the point, I think there's this kind of myth that what a lot of people do is, and it's put forward by adverts for laptops and things, that a lot of people spend a lot of their time working while sitting under a tree in the blazing sun or something like that.
Yeah.
And I really don't think
most
people
do that. Outside the UK, we have sun.
Right, I admit there is more sun in California than there is here in Birmingham. Right?
There's more sun everywhere than where you live, Ak.
However, I really don't think most people work like that. I look at, I just go to people's houses and things, and they've got a laptop, and it just sits on a desk, hardly ever moves.
What you're saying is not a critique on desktops versus laptop. You're saying that people are using their laptops wrong. So people are wrong, and they need to fix their working habits, get out of the house, and hit a barbecue joint with their laptop and get their work done. That's what I'm hearing.
I'm saying buy desktop machines. They're better.
Well, I think one thing about laptops as well is it's not just about traveling to conferences and stuff. It's just being able to go to places like a coffee shop or if you need to go to a friend's house for whatever reason and you have to finish up a piece of work on the way over. It just gives you a lot more flexibility. I agree with the notion of you could carry something else and your desktop could be your main machine. You could access that stuff on another device, but you might as well just buy one device, and that'd be a laptop. And
right, if you only have one device, the flexibility of a laptop definitely makes sense. If you're going to have two, then a desktop definitely makes sense.
I would absolutely agree with you if what I saw was people having one and only one device, and that was it. But I think there's this huge trend for people to have a laptop and an iPad, or a laptop and an Android tablet, or a laptop and a MacBook Air or something.
Yeah.
And something like the MacBook Air is explicitly designed to be your second laptop that you carry around. Hardly anyone uses it as their main and only machine.
But hang on a second. There is one good example of how I think you're wrong here. This example being, you're sat in a room which is just a couple of rooms over from where you would normally be sat on your laptop, where your desktop is currently located, and your networking is crap in the room that you're in right now. If you were on a laptop, you could just move, but you are tied down to the ground. He shoots, he scores.
Yep. It's the first time I've ever seen silence out of Ak.
Well, I think Stuart could respond right now, except his network was crappy.
Right, yes. And he can't move.
Aside from a look of incredulousness on his face.
Whistleblowing. Am I right, guys? It's it's a tricky beast because let's say you're in a company or in a government, some sort of organization doing something shady, something sinister. How do you get that information from said company, from your sweaty, nerdy little hands into the public without actually getting in trouble? It's kind of a trick. A lot of people don't seem to be pulling it off very well. I just kind of wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about that. See what you guys think about that. How do you accomplish that in today's day and age without getting mega busted?
Let's look at the history a little bit, right? So because there may be someone who's been living in a cave out there who hasn't heard of WikiLeaks and Snowden. But WikiLeaks was one of the first big cases that really hit the press, where, you know, these diplomatic cables were leaked. There was the whole Bradley Manning, who's now Laura Manning or whatever.
Chelsea Manning.
Chelsea Manning. And then, so there was that whole situation. And then, of course, there was Snowden with the NSA revelations. And one thing that's been clear is that when anybody has leaked, has acted as a whistleblower, they've got royally screwed in the process.
Yeah.
I think we'd all agree that whistleblowing when legal activity is happening is a good thing, but it's having a detrimental impact on those particular individuals. So I think we should break this up into two topics of discussion. One is there is the law, which can't change very easily from our perspective.
Right.
But how can people act within the law to, like, if we were to build whistleblowing 2.0, like, what would it look like?
I mean, I think the one thing you have to start with is where you should whistleblow, right? And that's, I think, you really have to be revealing to me some kind of egregious abuse or egregious injustice or something that's vastly illegal and is otherwise unlikely to be remedied. And then I think what goes along with that is the information that you're releasing really has to be proportionate and relevant to the abuse that you're trying to remedy. And then if you're in the case of a government, I think you also have to really kind of consider both public safety and legitimate operational safety along with that. Obviously, if you're talking about corporate side, that doesn't really apply. So I think you have to take that into consideration first and really define good whistleblowing versus just kind of sporadic.
Now, I think there's the problem because I think you're totally right, Jeremy. I agree 100%. But how would you, if you were crafting a law, how would you define that? I mean, how do you because it's such a gray area. It's something that's almost, you know, up to your own personal moral compass and judgment. I don't know how you create a law where you can say this is or isn't legal.
You need a bright line test, basically, something where you can say this is unambiguously this and this is unambiguously that. Now, the UK actually has specific protection for whistleblowers in law. So that's an attempt to precisely codify what you're allowed to do and what you aren't. So if you are blowing the whistle on a company, you're an employee of that company, you are protected from dismissal if you're reporting that someone's health and safety is in danger, or you're reporting damage to the environment, or you're reporting a criminal offence, or you're reporting that the company isn't obeying the law or that they're covering up wrongdoing, and you believe your disclosure is in the public interest, and you think the company is already covering it up, will screw you if you complain, or you've already told them and they haven't done anything about it. So that's a reasonable, you've got to do all three of those have to be true to qualify. The thing which, before you get the idea that the UK is some kind of brilliant paradise for this sort of thing, one of the big
I never thought that, just so you
nobody
know.
Nobody thought that.
No. Yeah. Jeremy, does anyone here, has everyone ever used those words? I don't think
the
so.
The UK is a beautiful paradise for boiled meat, but not for whistleblowing.
I do
You know, maybe we should have yoga instead, The big problem is that you can't, according to the whistleblower law, you can't break the law while whistleblowing, and the fact that you're revealing this stuff can't itself be against the law, and that includes the Official Secrets Act, which means that it's basically a law of protection for corporate whistleblowers, not national security whistleblowers.
And isn't in the public interest ambiguous enough that they could really get around, if they really wanted to prosecute you, they could say, well, that's not in the public interest.
There is a reasonable amount of precedent and case law on public interest stuff because it comes from libel trials. But yes, absolutely, it's arguable.
Oh, okay.
But then everything is. I mean, there are very few completely unambiguous laws. But
it seems like a big chunk of this discussion is about the policy and the approach to anonymity, right? Because so using Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden as examples, right? The three of them whistleblew or acted for an organization that caters to whistleblowers, and they did not hide their identities, and they've all been screwed in the process.
Yeah.
Now, I think the key thing that Jeremy touched on earlier on is making sure that the, you know, when somebody whistleblows and they provide evidence of wrongdoing, that it is proportional. Like, the thing I didn't like about WikiLeaks is it felt like such a massive, like, they were trying to make the point that the US government is doing bad things, and it seemed like such a massive and irresponsible way of doing things. Like, they just dumped these diplomatic cables, and it arguably put the lives of many people at risk.
But I think Snowden has learned from that. If you look at what Snowden's done, he's got a huge cache of documents. He's released some. He's not released them all. He's individually redacted some things. He's released them only to individual players who have then decided to publicise them or not. So he's learned from that overreaction.
I would agree.
I think his disclosure was significantly more responsible than the previous ones. I would definitely agree with that.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
But is this something that you guys think that technology could solve, right? So in terms of...
No.
It obviously takes a human being to determine what's the right level of content to provide as evidence as whistleblowing. It almost, to me, seems like the person who's whistleblowing needs to provide the minimum viable amount of evidence to demonstrate the wrongdoing.
The problem
has
is not really
as
the
opposed
evidence,
to
be honest with you. The problem is that if you remain anonymous, then it's much more difficult to prosecute you, but you are much less credible by doing so. Because someone's like, well, how do we haven't made these things up? If you say, I am this person, then your evidence is much more credible because it's much more likely that you actually did obtain it, that that you didn't just make these documents up, whatever. You had the opportunity to obtain this stuff that you're doing. But at that point, you're no longer anonymous and can be arrested. Technology can't help with that. Technology can help you remain anonymous and make it more difficult to know who you are, but it can't help with the credibility problem of anonymous whistleblowing.
And I think if your evidence is irrefutable, though, that becomes a moot point.
You know, I'm not entirely certain. I mean, there's really two critical points at which people can get really in a lot of trouble here. One is the person that finds the information with inside an organization that leaks it, and the second point is the reporters that actually report on and then publish that information. So even if people are really well protected under the law, under good whistleblowing laws that keep them safe, people are still going to sue them, companies are still going to go after them, and governments are still going to be pissed off that the leak occurred. So the people that are leaking that information still need viable protection. I am against anonymity in general. I can't stand people being anonymous on the internet. I think it's annoying and cowardly, except in this particular instance where having that anonymity provides someone with a reasonable protection to do what they feel is right and whistleblow when they need to. So projects like Strongbox and the like, where people can send information that they think might be interesting, that they think might be important to get out there to reporters that they think could investigate it further, and then it then falls on the shoulders of those individual reporters to see, is this really something that should be in the public's hands? And it's kind of almost the whistleblowing checks and balances, if you will. You need to have those two people involved in order to make that really occur.
But it seems as well that in many ways, I think one of the risks here is that one of the things I've learned over the years is that human beings will often, with a lack of information, very quickly jump to conclusions, right? So we see this on a small scale in open source, people who don't have a certain amount of information about what's happening. So they assume ill will. And what worries me is that with the growing public awareness of whistleblowing, is that people are going to end up whistleblowing about things that are not really unlawful. The things that they just don't like.
Yeah, that's what I very much agree with Brian. You do need that check and balance to ensure that kind of stuff doesn't happen.
Right.
Sunlight's the best disinfectant, though. Is there stuff that your company would be embarrassed by having it in public, even if it's not illegal, maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
Well, sunlight's the best disinfectant, but it also causes melanoma sometimes, so you got to be careful.
Right.
I'm just wondering I take what you say.
I wonder whether there could be a system whereby, for example, imagine Joe Bloggs whistleblows about something, but that whistleblowing is only considered a legitimate whistleblowing if certain other individuals who have some level of reputable status, maybe they also work for the organization, act as testimonials for that whistleblowing. So you can imagine Joe Bloggs works for the government and alleges that the government have a secret base out in Nevada where they're doing experiments on kittens, for a whole new kitten army that's going to take over.
Really not cool.
It's not cool. So what happens is now if Joe Bloggs comes out and whistleblows that, just as Snowden did, arguably Joe Bloggs could be seen as either crazy or as just on his own, and it's easy to refute that particular person's whistleblowing.
Right.
If Joe Bloggs then says, me and five other people who also work here can back that up, at that point it goes public. I'm wondering whether that should be a better approach.
That's ridiculous, right? By definition, anyone who's prepared to stand up for Snowden can't be a reputable government witness because either they're also in Russia or they're in prison. Right, if Snowden
right, but that's what I'm
US,
saying. That
oh, so now if I come across a bunch of stuff and I have a crisis of conscience like Snowden did, I have to find five other people who are prepared to throw their lives away as well.
And also not one that's going to blow you in before it goes. I mean,
yeah, what exactly. I'm saying
that's
is, nuts. I wonder whether I want
massively
what I'm saying
of
is that
companies in the government.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that this approach could arguably, what you could arguably say is that when there are multiple people who are alleging the same level of wrongdoing, who are all willing to put their shit on the line, they should all have protection. It reinforces the fact that that wrongdoing is happening. Maybe that could be the new level of policy.
So,
but
right?
in
so
pursuit
what
of
so
getting those
get
other
fired,
people, you're very often going to get caught ahead of time.
If you, what, I'm just what you're suggesting is if you get five people who leak national security secrets, right, then they cannot be prosecuted for it.
No, what I'm saying is if one person is going to whistleblow, and five, imagine you have some kind of infrastructure, whistleblowers.net or something,
yeah,
right?
Nice.
Which probably exists, right? One person wants to whistleblow through this standard system, kind of a better version of WikiLeaks, but it will only go public if there can be five other people from the same organization who are willing to add testimonials that wrongdoing is happening. To me, that would provide a stronger sense of assurance.
If it goes public and it's found that you did the wrong thing by whistleblowing, what happens to you? You go to prison for leaking national security stuff.
Yes.
Right?
There also seems to be too many unintended consequences with that, too. What if you five people are coerced into leaking something that legitimately should have been secret?
Right.
And more to the point, I think there's
too many problems
to me,
with that setup.
But if you're gonna give a testimonial, then you like that's personal responsibility. You can't do a lot about
it.
What I'm saying is that I think
we already have an incredibly hostile environment for someone like Edward Snowden, requiring to also come with five people who are also prepared to move to Moscow and never see their family again makes it even more unlikely that we'd have found out.
Right,
about
and what I'm saying is that I think that this could potentially be a system that would prevent against that. What it will be is it will be saying, like, what worries me is that I guarantee you over the next couple of years, we're going to see whistleblowing after whistleblowing case happening.
Yep,
and a lot
great.
Of it will not, a lot of it won't hit the major headlines because it'll be some crackhead who works in the State Department will whistleblow, who will leak national security secrets. And it will be because they don't like the government, right? And it will be under the veil of whistleblowing. Whistleblowing right. will become an excuse. And what I'm saying is that if there was a system in place like WikiLeaks where testimonials were driving the authenticity of that whistleblowing, that could arguably act as not only a means of legitimizing that that's actually happening, because there's more than one person who's saying that it's happening, but it could also arguably act as a level of protection because then it's not just one crackhead on the internet who's saying that the government's doing this particular thing. It's a group of people. I think it's a strengthening
numbers.
It's
a group
thing.
Of crackheads.
I agree that kicking off, this means more risk for each of those different people. But I think that for whistleblowing 2.0, that could be a
method. I think the absolute opposite. That sounds to me like, I mean, are you being paid to suggest this by Clapper? For God's sake, right? You're making it less likely that people will take the risk.
I hate to do this, but I agree with Stuart on this one.
Thank you.
I kind of
yes.
feel like part of what we have right now
that
works.
Jono yeah, is so you know, wrong that Brian and I agree on something. Does this not tell you
that's
something?
Kind of astounding right now.
No, it's okay. If Brian agrees with you, that kind of adds more legitimacy to my arguments.
Works for me. Here's how part of how we have it right now, where there's a bit of a checks and balances, where we have people in the journalists who are theoretically trained to ask the right questions to try and find and legitimize the information, the facts behind a single case of whistleblowing before presenting it to the public, I think provides us with enough of that right now as it is. That's personally how I feel.
Why I think it's currently incredibly tilted against someone who wants to do this is Snowden can't give his information to a journalist and then have some kind of a trial decide whether he did the right or wrong thing, whether this was in the public interest and so on. Because if he'd sat there in New York or whatever and said, well, let's see how the trial works out. He'd already be in prison. Everyone's been very, very clear that there'd barely been a trial at all. He'd have got shipped off to Gitmo, for God's sake, right? He had to flee to Russia.
Yeah, but the issue there is not through the approach to whistleblowing. It's with the fact that he whistleblew in the first place, right?
There ought to be more of it, no less.
Comparing and contrasting whether it's one person, whether it's five people, is a different question to comparing and contrasting whether, you know, it's right, the rights and wrongs of whistleblowing. I agree with you that there should be more whistleblowing, so long as it is done in a responsible manner, right?
How is what Snowden did not?
I'm not saying it isn't
right.
I never said that it was irresponsible. But you want to make it more difficult. So long as it's done in a responsible.
But you want to make it more difficult for him to do that. It already took an incredible act of personal and moral courage to do what he did, to convince five other people to throw themselves on that same grenade at the same time. Would, in practice, have meant that he wouldn't have done it at all.
I think strength of evidence is significantly more important than number of people in almost every case. Personally.
Bingo. Right. Bingo. And I admit that what I'm suggesting here arguably is
a terrible
antidote.
Idea.
So it's the antidote to
what I see in the future
of leaks.
It's the antidote to what I see in the future as what's going to become a growing problem, which is where we're going to have a lot of bullshit whistleblowers. Like today, we've had a couple of whistleblowers who have generally been pretty legitimate, right?
Yeah.
But I think in the future, we're going to see an era of bullshit whistleblowers, and I'm saying that we'll need a new way of doing things.
I think this was just one idea that I came up with in this segment. Yeah, no, I mean, I can see that. And I grant you that might become a problem, but attempting to protect against that potential future problem now is less important than fixing the problem we currently have at the moment.
So, on the show today, I'm delighted to bring on Miguel de Casa. Many of you will know Miguel's long body of work. He's the co-founder of the GNOME Project. He was the founder of Zimian back in the day. And these days, he is the founder of Xamarin. So how are you doing, Miguel? Good to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me here, guys. I'm doing great. Enjoying this new project that we jumped on a couple of years ago. With my longtime friend, Nat Friedman.
Yeah. So just to get started, why don't you give us a quick overview of what Xamarin is so our listeners know what you guys are doing?
Yeah, so it all, it kind of goes back to, you know, it all starts with GNOME. It all starts with GNOME. And the goals of GNOME were to make Linux usable and create a, you know, user-friendly Unix experience. And the involvement in the project changes over time. You know, one day you're building libraries, the next day you're building applications. And as we evolve our thought in GNOME, you know, one of the things that we got involved with was creating developer tools, and in particular programming languages. So I got very interested in the C# programming language from Microsoft, and I wanted to bring that to Linux. So I worked on that for a few years, and Mono kind of went through different paths. Initially, it was a programming language for building desktop applications, very much intended to be used for GNOME. Then it was used for server applications at Novell, which was one of Novell's interests. And towards the end of its life at Novell, we got Mono running on iOS, and that was an exciting development because the iOS platform had a couple of unique challenges for compilers. So we worked on that, and we managed to produce a C# environment that would run on iOS. And roughly around that time, they shut down the effort at Novell. Novell was acquired, They laid off the entire Mono team off, and I got together with my friend Nat Friedman, and we said, we can take this forward. We can actually take this developer technology that at that point we felt very, very passionate about, and we were also very passionate about iOS and Android. And we decided to start a company around this, So we got together, funded the company for the first, for that first year, and got all of the people that Novell had laid off. We got the team that Novell had laid off, and sort of the company with that. So ever since, kind of our mission went from, you know, make Linux, like I said, it was an evolution of making Linux relevant in the desktop to now our current mission is creating great developer tools to delight developers. That's really our focus, making great developer tools for developers. And in particular, in this case, we think that we have something to offer on the mobile space, and that's what we're doing.
Right. So it seems like you know, anyone who's been observing your work over the years, it obviously seems like you've kind of, your interest has moved away from the desktop side of things as much, and obviously into the developer tooling space. What's your view on the Linux desktop today? I mean, do you feel like the Linux desktop isn't competitive, or is it just that your personal interests have adjusted?
I think it's a blend of both. Open source is a blessing, and it's a combination of things. It's a great developer. It's a great developer platform. It's a great environment. It's a great collaboration. It's a great equalizer. It empowers people that previously didn't have that power. I mean, open source is still it's a force of nature at this point. It's like the ocean. It's it creates life. It's we all come from the ocean at one point or another. So it's a little bit like the ocean in that way, but it's also as untamable as the ocean is. And in some cases, I think that it's been very well, people have managed to harness it and harness that power very well, in particular in the server space. The desktop, I think, has been a lot more complicated for Linux, because some of the power that comes with open source, some of these freedoms that come with open source, also they're a little bit too free, and they allow maybe a little bit too much of different opinions to fragment the space. So the desktop, the server, probably nobody cares how fragmented it is, because most of the server apps are open source, and there's a very thin layer that you need to run a server. And the proof is, you can run Docker today, and Docker really doesn't provide very much. You don't really need very much to run a Docker system. But a desktop is a complicated set of services and programs and interactions and components. And not having a way of doing things and having too much freedom, I think, caused the fragmentation that we have today. So it's been a little bit painful for me to watch that.
Fair enough. Hey, Miguel, this is Brian. Now, along those lines, and just to show where we're coming from here, pretty much everyone on this show at one point or another has had significant disagreements with Richard Stallman. However, I believe that you are the only person in the known universe to be effectively labeled as a traitor by Richard Stallman, and I kind of wanted to know how that made you feel, and do you dream about that at night when you sleep?
No, I do not dream about that when I sleep. I don't remember exactly the context of comment from Richard. I think it had to do with Mono in some capacity. I don't remember the comment exactly, but
it was around your leaving of kind of the Linux world, when you kind of went over to more the Mac side of things, and you made a few statements. I believe it was along the lines of the Linux desktop wasn't as competitive, or was killed by Apple, or something like that. And then Richard deemed you an official traitor of free and open source software.
I thought, I don't remember. I'll take your word for that. I just remember, what I remember at this point, is that I felt at the time that he made that statement out of misinformation. Sadly, Richard has made a couple of statements regarding Mono and about my position with open source that have been driven out of misinformation. I think that a lot of people portrayed Mono as a submarine attack on open source, that there was some kind of evil plan between Microsoft and me to do something. And I think that people presented that twisted story as fact to Richard, and Richard took it at face value and made some, has made statements along the lines for many years that way. I don't resent him. I think that Richard's a very fact-driven person. Now, the problem is that sometimes the facts that he gets might be a little twisted, but you know, if you were to rectify some facts, Richard would change his position, which is, it's good about Richard, right? He's very methodical about that, and he's very consistent. So it really didn't bother me at the time. I mean, it bothers me that people have spread during many, many years a lot of lies. And a lot of it is, you know, conspiracy nature in kind. So that did bother me. But I think that Richard, if he was ever presented with a real fact, would have a problem. Now, that being said, I think that Richard today would disagree with my choice of business model that I've taken. And that, I think, would qualify certainly as something that Richard does not appreciate. And I'm okay right with that. And it's the fact that Xamarin, well, we built a lot of our technology based on open source software. At Xamarin, we've chosen to make our software proprietary. And the lesson, probably the lesson was that, well, I think that a few companies are in a strong enough position to make a living out of open source, like Red Hat and SUSE and Canonical. It's you know, in the year 2000, we thought that we're going to have 100 Red Hats and that the software industry would be dominated by Red Hats. And that just didn't happen. There's one Red Hat. And maybe there's a few other open source companies that have made an important contribution, but the stock markets did not see the rise of 100 Red Hats to replace 100 proprietary software companies.
Right.
So I think that there's still value. I mean, there's still a lot of great open source businesses, but I was interested in the business of creating software, and I just changed my mind as to what is actually fundable and what is not. So we've chosen a proprietary model for that.
So kind of related on that note, one of the things we're trying to do with our interviews on Bad Voltage is to try and understand the person behind the software and to try and, you know, to get behind the mask, if you will, a little bit. One thing I wanted to ask you, Miguel, is over the years, the traitor thing was just one example, which when we were talking, like preparing for the interview, we just couldn't believe that, you know, why you? Like, I mean, everybody, Richard basically disagrees with almost anybody on the internet because almost anybody compromises in some way when it comes to software freedom. But over the years, you've received probably more than your fair share of flack from people. Just as a person, irrespective of the software and your companies and whatever else, how have you coped with that over the years? I mean, you know, not everybody is born with a thick skin. And when you were young and starting out in this world, it must have been pretty complicated in the same way that it was for many of us. But how have you dealt over the years with dealing with sometimes quite personalized criticism?
Tell us how you feel.
Actually, I'm glad that you asked that question. Because, you know, I love that you care, John. So, you know, always. I certainly appreciate the question. Because, yeah, it was actually very, very annoying to receive this, you know, it was assorted attacks from threats to, and a couple of guys telling me they're going to kill me for doing a open source that they didn't agree with, to all kinds of, you know, nasty grams.
Right.
I think there were two things that helped me during that time. One is that at one point you invest. And maybe this is not good. I mean, maybe this is not a good example, but at one point in your life, you invest a lot of resources into something, and it really doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. You're going to keep doing it because that's what you enjoy doing. So there was certainly a driver for that in the mono space. At one point, like, hey, at least invested a lot on this thing. I'll make this work one way or another, despite what people might say. So I think that was a component of it. There was also a component that people were working for me at the Bell. I felt that I had an obligation to their jobs, and I had an obligation to keep those people employed. So there was certainly an element of me continuing to push the project because there were people's jobs at stake and people's visions and personal investments and time investments. And I felt that I owed them at least my best effort to keep going. And the third one was that in the year 2000, I met a guy. He's a director of the Boston Philharmonic, and he wrote a book called The Art of Possibility. But most importantly, I met him in person. And his whole vision of life is basically that, you know, he has a bunch of lessons in his book. You should check it out. But it was a very positive outlook on life, and it basically didn't depend very much on what other people thought or said or did. It was about what made you happy and what kind of things or strategies you can use to cope against adversity. So, you know, his name is Benjamin Zander, and although I met him in 2000, I didn't really get to know him until 2008 or so.
Right.
But ever since 2000, I tried to follow his teachings. And in fact, there's going to be a concert this Friday of the Boston Philharmonic, and his birthday is on Saturday, where he's inviting all of his students of, you know, 50 years to come and
Wow. Yeah, we don't listen to hippy-dippy music like that around here.
He's you know, the director of the Philharmonic, so he's a, you know, classical music instructor. He has a great TED Talk, in fact, one of the most inspiring TED Talks I've seen, which is, I don't remember the title, but it talks about why people don't like classical music. And
Miguel, I gotta say, this all sounds like very traitorous talk to me, and I'm not okay with it. It sounds traitorous.
It is a little bit traitorous. Yeah, I agree. There's the element of it. Hip hop is the thing. So, anyways, so those were the three things. I think those are the three things that kept me going for all these years. And I'm glad I did, because in the end, we ended up with Xamarin. We ended up in what today is. I mean, it's a fascinating, I mean, this space where everybody's really carrying a little computer on their pocket, these actually supercomputers on their pockets, that they do almost as much stuff as what the kind of computing power we used to have back when we started GNOME. But now it's in their pockets, it's communicated, yeah. It has access to the internet. Innovation is just off the charts in this space. So we're having a blast. It's really a fun space to be in, and and I think that we're delivering great solutions for people. So.
Fantastic!
That's wonderful. That's the most boring thing I've ever heard. That's boring, dude.
I know. And the other thing is, you know, we have a lot of enterprise customers, which you know, we're trying to make enterprise software fun as well. So, you know, we serve everybody from game developers, which is as fun as it can get, and you know, 30% of the games on the top charts on both the Google and App Stores are powered by Mono. So one of every three games that you get from the top charts is powered by C# and Mono, which I think is a big deal. And on the other side of the spectrum, we also want to help insurance companies and banks provide services and kind of more boring things. So we're you know, we're all over the place. It's you know, back in the Linux days, I could count with two hands all of the software written with Mono. I would say, we got F-Spot, and we got Beagle, and we got this and that.
The success of Mono is great and all that, but has it allowed you to port Midnight Commander to iOS and get it out on the App Store?
I think that's really the important question.
That is a solid point. That is a solid point, and I think it goes... And the next point is, you know, I no longer have a lot of time to write software, and I spent it mostly managing. But I did start a port of Midnight Commander to C#, which I never finished. And it's one of my big regrets, because the new version is really nice.
Do you consider Midnight Commander one of your seminal works, I would think?
Well, I don't know if it's one of my seminal works, but I can tell you one thing. I still use it on a daily basis. And I still think that I'm more efficient than most Unix people because I use Midnight Commander. So it's my secret weapon.
There's two weapons.
One is I write about 90 words per minute, and second, I type at 90 words per minute, and also I have Midnight Commander.
Miguel, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut you off right there, but I want to thank you for coming on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, Miguel de Acasa, fast typer, author of Midnight Commander, and trader to open source. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Miguel.
Thank you so much, Miguel. Guys. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
Recently, we kicked off our very first Bad Voltage competition, which we called the Bad Voltage Selfie Contest. And the idea was very, very simple. We put online a little downloadable PDF that says, I love me some Bad Voltage, and then you print it out and take a picture of yourself with it. And the idea is that you take fun and interesting pictures, and then you can win yourself either 5 O'Reilly books, which is for the winner, or 3 O'Reilly books for the runner-up. So first of all, obviously, thanks to O'Reilly for providing free books.
Yes.
Content.
Nice one, I write.
You guys, hold up a second. Before we announce the winner, I would just like to make a point. If you go over and look through all of the entries, there are no ladies. This is a contest filled with guys taking pictures of themselves and sending it to other guys. I just wanted to point that out right now before we announce the winners of this contest.
It is our version of chat roulette.
it is.
There's no Batman, though. So we had a great response. We had a ton of pictures submitted, which we're really happy with. Because
I was really impressed with the response, I have to say.
Yeah. So and some pretty funny ones as well. So without further ado, we're going to go through and we're going to announce the winner. So, Ak, why don't you tell us the winner?
Okay. The person who actually won, basically because we went through and we did a little bit of kind of a scoring thing between all of us. And one picture came out.
And we did a fair amount of deliberation just to let people know.
We did. Yeah. Really, proper arguing about this. And the picture which came up top was basically everybody's top picture, which was by Andris. And he had a picture of himself sitting on his sofa with sparks flying everywhere.
He had jumper cables brilliant. Hooked up to a car battery.
It
was jumper cables hooked up to a car battery, and he was smacking those sons of bitches together. It was rad.
Yeah. It's amazing. He's got this kind of Jean-Claude. He's got this Jean-Claude Van Damme kind of look on his face as well, which I quite like.
So. And anyone prepared to, you know, prepared to burn down his own house in order to get O'Reilly books. Fair play to him. We salute you, sir. Congratulations, you have won. You've won the prize.
Yeah, do not repeat that with all the books underneath, I would say.
I would say not.
So, Brian.
Yeah. For runner up, we got Cedion. I think I'm saying that right. The guy has a picture of him, very stylistic shot against a brick wall where he's eating some, I'm assuming, live electrical cables. I just assume. because he looks hardcore, so I assume they would be live.
People have picked up the voltage theme here, haven't they?
Yeah. I like that. Now, it has to be said, though, that when we were going through the extensive deliberation to pick the winners, there was some debate. All of us thought, like, the same set of pictures were really cool. But we were a little bit divided on the runner-up, and that's the reason why we're gonna split the runner-up prize in two. The reason why is because we had a draw in terms of votes between Cedion with his cable eating, as well as Gertz, who had a picture of him just sat there with a Popeye t-shirt on and this random sausage dog just looking chivalrous in this picture. So we felt that Cedion had like the, you know, it's very symbolic of Bad Voltage and the rest of it. But Gertz, that picture just made us giggle.
Picture was pure, dude.
What we're going to do is we're going to, and I'm sure that Andris, who's the winner, won't mind, but we're going to basically give Andris 4 books instead. And then we're going to divide up the remaining books, which is going to be 4 books. So Cedion can pick 2 and Gertz can pick 2. So we'll be in touch. We'll mention this on the Bad Voltage forum. We'll announce the winners there. And then each of you needs to get in touch with us and let us know which books that you want.
Okay, so send us an email at show@badvoltage.org.
Yeah.
The winners.
So Jeremy.
In addition to that, while it's clear that a lot of people put some time, thought, and effort into this, we just want to give an honorable mention and a special shout-out to Landon, who put an especially large amount of effort clearly into this, and we really do appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of pictures from Landon. And they were very cool, bringing his son into it and all the rest of it. So.
Yeah, no, good work.
Missed it by that much.
Yeah, yeah, very close. Like yes, Landon nearly had it as well. So thank you everyone for participating. We'll have obviously many more competitions in the future where you can win cool prizes, and keep your eyes on community.badvoltage.org for more.
So, you know what I think it's time for now, guys? I think it's time to do a little recap of what's happened in the community since the last episode. And there has been, once again, just the amount of participation that we've gotten in the community just continues to grow. I know the how you got into Linux discussion really got kicked off. I know there's over 30 responses to that. And I know you have a few stats from the discourse forum, Jono. So why don't you let us know what's going on there?
So we've been seeing a ton of growth. Obviously, you know, we started the community.badvoltage.org a little while back. And it, you know, from past experience of running podcasts and stuff like that, it takes a little while for things to get going. And I'd say in particular in the last two or three weeks, particularly since the last show, we've been having just a lot more regularity, people hanging out, getting to know each other. We now have over 130 people who are actively participating in the forum, which is great.
It's rad.
And we've just seen the traffic that's hitting badvoltage.org, you know, just constantly growing as well. So, you know, I just want to mention as well that we'd like to say a big thank you to A2 Hosting, who are now providing the hosting for community.badvoltage.org. We used to host it on a Microsoft Azure instance, and then we outgrew that. So big thank you to Microsoft for providing the Azure instance while we were getting things going. But big thank you to A2 Hosting as well. They provide fantastic hosting. I use them, Mac uses them. And then, you know, long-standing thank you as well to Bytemark Hosting from England, who have been providing the audio hosting for Bad Voltage as well as Lug Radio for many, many years. So great growth. But as ever, you know, tell your friends about Bad Voltage, get people involved. It just makes a fun community for everyone.
Oh, and I wanted to mention that we're still rocking and rolling with getting some kind of gaming going within the community. Dankles over in the forum has a gaming server set up for Team Fortress 2. He had a test run this last Sunday. How many people on the show, can I get a raise of hands, were there on Sunday? No hands went up. But 12 people did show up. None of the actual hosts of the show, mind you. We were all too busy with our amazing celebrity lives. But we're going to do another one officially soon. We haven't scheduled anything yet, but we'll try and schedule one a bit further out. Maybe we can get everyone together and have a good frag fest.
In Jeremy and my defense, we were traveling. So
you were traveling. I was on a date. Stuart was at home crying. So
Stuart was at home alone and not traveling.
In my defense, I don't give a shit about Team Fortress 2, but I know lots of other people do.
That's a good game, so man. That's great. All right. Fine.
Yeah, like 12 people showed up, though.
But big thanks to Dankles for doing all that stuff and get that set up.
Yeah, thanks again, Dankles.
Thanks, Dankles.
Everyone say Dankles a few more times.
Other stuff which is showing up, we've got an IRC channel as well, #badvoltage on irc.freenode.net, and there's a bot, I'm told. What does the bot do?
Well, so Nero, who's a long-time listener of Lug Radio, I asked him if he could set up a bot for the channel, which is going to set the topic to the latest version of the show. And you know, we're thinking about having like a glossary of bits and pieces in there. So just the bot can be anything that's of interest to Bad Voltage listeners. Oh, cool. So if you're an IRC user, it's pretty small community in there right now because we're still getting it up and running. Hey, we're going to add a page.
I'm in there right now, baby. Brian Lunduk is in the Bad Voltage channel right now, lighting it up.
Right now. We're going to add like a web view to the IRC channel on badvoltage.org so people can easily go and join if they want to, if they're new to IRC. But if you want to chat to people in real time, that's a good place to get started.
And then I'm just going to kind of highlight one thread that, and let me preface this with saying, personally, I think episode 7 so far was my personal favorite. And one of the segments on there was the Mars One segment, which the discussion that kicked off in the forum has just been astounding. It's over a month later and it's still going. And I think one thing that some people in the forum or in the community seem to be mildly confused is that we don't think it's a good idea to go to Mars. I think universally, we unanimously think it's a good decision and probably will happen someday. Just that particular Mars One project that we were discussing was unviable. Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah,
with.
Man, the three of you guys are getting branded as people that hate space, and I'm the awesome one that wants to go to space. So I just want to tell everyone on the internet, thank you.
It's like, no, we think going to Mars is a great idea. We just don't think that NASA, doing it through I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here to Mars on a reality show is the way forward.
Interstellar Jersey Shore.
Stu, keep it in the forum, baby.
keep it in the forum. So the other thing as well is that we now have a Bad Voltage Ubuntu app. There's this weird, morbidly obese guy that has put it together.
He's not weird.
Screw all of you.
So Ack wrote a very cool little app that basically generates podcasting clients for Ubuntu for smartphones. So like it's being used for like a Doctor Who podcast and the Ubuntu UK podcast and stuff like that. So if you are an Ubuntu for smartphones user, if you've installed it on your phone, then you can go into the software store and you can do a search for Bad Voltage and get it. Now, to be very clear as well, we'd love to see clients for other platforms. So if there's Android developers out there, iPhone developers out there, then we'd love to see an app. Just before you publish it, just get in touch with us because we want to make sure that it represents the quality of Bad Voltage.
Quality.
And on the topic of Jono and I traveling on Sunday, that travel was actually for Scale, which is the Southern California Area Linux Expo. And as Jono and I mentioned, it's actually where we met about 10 years ago and one of both of our favorite tech conferences. Now, something I want to kind of underscore from that, and as always, Scale is a great show. On Saturday, both Jono and I wore Bad Voltage shirts. And the number of people that individually we had come up to us and say, hey, it's a great show, and had been listeners and had feedback. It's really great to get that feedback in the forum, but to get it in person just is, I think absolutely wonderful. I don't know your thoughts on that, Jono, but I was surprised how many people actually came up to us.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, because we've said this before, but, it takes a little while to get a podcast going. You're like, show one and show 10 are often very different in terms of quality. I went and listened to our first show about a week ago, and it's very different. So I think it's getting better. But it's good to hear that people are enjoying it, and we're still very much at the beginning. But it was nice to get a bit of that kind of validation at Scale as we're walking around in our Bad Voltage Cafe Press T-shirts that we both took a mortgage out to buy. And mine's blurry because I've washed it. So as ever, if you want to go and share your thoughts and ideas, go to community.badvoltage.org. That's where our community hangs out. Be sure to keep an eye out for the gaming contest that Dankles is going to get up and running pretty soon. And of course, #badvoltage on Freenode if you want to do the IRC thing.
Thank you very much and good night.
That's what happens when you give Ack approximately 10 seconds notice to outro the show.
That was beautiful.
I didn't think I'd get away with that, to be honest with you. But yes, that's the end of the show.
No, you didn't.
That's
your second
cut.
Attempt.
Hey, very nice.
That's the director's cut. All right. Well, we've had a good show. Interesting topics. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Before we close, big thank you again to all of our selfies that got sent in. Big thanks again to Microsoft for helping to host the community.badvoltage.org forum until we switched over to A2 hosting because we've outgrown Azure a little bit, all of Azure. And of course, get your thoughts and ideas and comments into our fantastic and growing community at community.badvoltage.org. And of course, the #badvoltage channel, IRC channel on the Freenode network. Do we have anything else? Am I forgetting anything?
Every second you take is just holding Ack up from going to the pub.
Yeah, we should go on longer. Let's have a talk about feelings.
The never-ending episode of Bad Voltage.
Oh, you're aware, man. I could just reboot and leave you guys to talk about feelings, right?
Dude, I can't believe you started asking Mikhail Diakaza about feelings, Jono. Like, seriously, this might as well be like the warm kitty and puppy hour. Like, that's... That's a ridiculous thing. Why don't we have big tech luminaries on from all across the globe and just ask them how they feel today?
That sounds like a really good idea. Let's do that.
Actually, as I'm saying it being sarcastic, I'm thinking that sounds awesome.
We should do that. We should bring people along. Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
No talking about tech, just how are you feeling today? All right,
go to you know. You get people on from all walks of technical life and ask them what their favourite biscuit is or whatever. It'd be brilliant.
I think that's a whole different episode. That may, the yeah, biscuit episode. All right.
May go on for a while.
All right. This episode is over. Hey, Stuart, go drink heavily.
And you know, if you had a laptop, you could move while you were recording this and be halfway there by now.
Yeah, seriously.
On the other hand, then I'd be a guy who sits with his laptop in the pub, which you lot seem to think is cool. I do not.
I agree, because sitting in the pub with your phone is totally different.
And on that note, thanks for listening.